jobs usually feel anxious about their ability to meet the demands of the adult world.
Their social skills have not been honed. They are often temperamentally shy,
and they feel expectations for success that they don't think they can meet. Online or video gaming offers a world in which they can succeed. They are quickly rewarded for success, and failure is easily reversed. Gaming addiction doesn't represent a dark side to play any more than obesity represents a dark side to food. On the whole, three-dimensional physical and social play is a better form of play, just as a balanced diet is better than one full of sugar hits. The latter provides more instant gratification, but is damaging in the long term. We need both play and food to remain healthy. When we overdo it, the fault lies not in the play or in the food, but in ourselves. In fact, being too obsessed with play can be an important indicator about psychological gaps we face in other aspects of our lives. At one point in my life, in my 40s, I did a lot of running and spent too much time preoccupied with putting in the most miles and beating my personal best times.
Even with all I knew about play then, I regret to say that I didn't realize that drivenness had overtaken much of my life, both personal and professional.
It took a personal life crisis for me to take stock and wake up to what I had known intellectually was the importance of regular authentic play in my life. By being driven to work and play feverishly, overcommitted to profession, family, and physical conditioning, I had lost the life-enhancing rewards true play provides. This is not to say that I did not take refreshing vacations or play exuberantly on occasion, but my overall life was pressured, work-oriented, and consistently requiring more than I could accomplish without losing sleep or shortchanging my private needs for personal play. Looking back, I see that what I would have done differently is to incorporate play earlier and more consistently in my professional life, and to set clear boundaries about working too hard. I think that I artificially separated work and play in my own mind, which was a major blunder. In the family setting, I would have tried to incorporate play more into helping the kids with their homework, and brought more lightness into the work that needed to be done around the house. I was so driven to accomplish so much in my professional life, and I carried that attitude into the home. The past 21 years of play exploration have been transformational for me personally and provided the direct experience that grounds this book emotionally. Breaking the Rules. There are some play theoreticians who believe that play is always a good thing, and that there are no downsides to play. I don't view play as always sweetness and light. Play can be dangerous. People do get hurt. Rough-and-tumble play is typical among all juvenile mammals, including humans. Part of the rough-and-tumble is that often someone goes a little too far. In dogs, you might see the hurt dog yelp and snap back. In children, one kid might exclaim, "Hey, that really hurt," and perhaps strike out. A breakdown of play into a fight can be seen regularly on most open playgrounds. In a healthy situation, the kids pause for a moment while the herder lets the hurt know that it was unintentional, perhaps nonverbally, by taking the return hit or displaying a concerned expression, and the play resumes. Both have learned something about how far they can go. It might seem paradoxical, but such episodes allow the kids to be closer and even more free in their play, especially now that they have discovered where their own boundaries lie. When I talk about rough-and-tumble play, most people envision boys, and it's true that boys engage in physical play more often than girls. But girls often engage in a version of rough-and-tumble play that has a strong psychological component. It might involve more role-playing, gossip, teasing, or exclusionary clique formation. A mean girl who operates by psychological intimidation and exclusion is the equivalent of a boy bully, both of which interrupt the flow of play. As with physical rough-and-tumble play, kids are hurt. But in a healthy situation, girls learn what constitutes going too far and are closer as a result. In both cases, I think we as adults are too quick to step in to stop such play. We see the potential for small hurts, hear the squeals and grunts that sound to us like loss of control, and we force the wrestlers to stop. We feel uncomfortable with the gossipy talk, and we reflexively step in to make sure that kids are being fair. By doing so, we stop kids from learning on their own and from each other. Of course, when it is clear that there is a risk of serious physical injury, more than a bruise or scrape, or permanent psychological damage, we need to act on our responsibilities as parents or playground supervisors. But in most cases, it might be far better to let things play out. If things don't go well, we can come back later and ask the kids whether they felt okay about the emotional or physical rough and tumble. The kids usually give us the clues. In authentic rough and tumble play, the participants squeal, smile, and laugh while hitting, diving, wrestling, chasing, and heckling. And they remain friends after the bout is over. One of the hopes I have for bringing more healthy play into our future is to have the National Institute for Play help provide preschool teachers with sound, useful information about early rough and tumble play. If rough and tumble play is squelched because it is seen as chaotic, loud, out of control, its benefits will not be acquired. Kids need a certain amount of this play so that the later stages of development will proceed more smoothly. On the other hand, bullying and exclusionary over-the-top behavior is forestalled if it is nipped in the bud in preschool situations. Teachers and parents need to understand what's normal and what's not. Many people don't realize that rough-and-tumble play can continue into adulthood and may be necessary to healthy relationships. We don't physically tackle or punch each other anymore, but we engage in the mock wrestling we call teasing, joshing, kidding, or joking. Teasing varies by culture and individual temperament, but some form exists everywhere, especially when people are emotionally close. As I mentioned in the last chapter, teasing allows people to go to the edge and just beyond, saying things that may or may not be hurtful if said straight out, offering all parties an escape if they have gone too far. Such teasing is a learned through play social skill, with culturally understood boundaries. If the intent is to enlighten or just have fun, teasing and joke-making are great elements of social bonding. If the underlying motive is to put down or humiliate the recipient, it's not healthy. In many of their movies, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy used teasing banter to safely explore issues of power in relationships. There's a nice example of affectionate teasing in the movie Good Will Hunting, when friends Will, Matt Damon, and Chucky, Ben Affleck, express their feelings without getting all squishy about it. Chucky: "Hey, asshole." Will: "What, bitch?" Chucky: "Happy birthday." My family is a collection of champion teasers. At age 62, my cousin Al is in great shape and still plays and coaches hockey. But when we meet, we start verbally cutting each other. Me: "You've lost all your hair." Al: "Well, that's an impressive paunch you've got." Me: "You look like you've hit 90. Al: "I'm surprised you are still alive." Occasionally, it's a little uncomfortable. But you learn to roll with it, you learn to be ready for it, and underneath it all, I know that it comes from a foundation of love. Teasing about how we look is actually a way of saying, "You look pretty good for your age." I wouldn't tease about how bad he looked if he were on his deathbed. Or maybe I might, if he expected me to tease him. And by not teasing, I was making him worried that he actually looked pretty bad. That's the complex nature of teasing. Its very complexity signals that the teasers are emotionally close, that they know each other well enough to know how far to push it. Play, by its very nature, is a little anarchic. It's about stepping outside of normal life and breaking normal patterns. It's about bending the rules of thought, action, and behavior. Some people use this quality of play as cover for sadistic or cruel treatment of others. Hey, they might say if others object, you can't take a little playful hassling. What's wrong with you? This is not a dark side of play, because it is not play. It's an attack under a false flag. It is an attempt to dominate, demean, or control while hiding behind the bulwark of our cultural assumptions about play being non-threatening. In normal play, we may still hurt each other by going too far in bending the social rules. Kids may use play to safely explore their capacities for power, but end up dominating others. Adults may joke about something that's a little too personal, but when our interactions are based on a foundation of caring, these hurts are corrected and avoided in the future. Bending rules and pushing through limits should happen within the realm of play. They aren't the dark side of play. They are the essence of play. Chapter 8. A World at Play. I have a wonderful memory. I am on the Serengeti Plain watching a pride of lions. They are mostly belly up, sleeping and yawning after a big feed. Suddenly, two adolescent lionesses who have been wrestling and rolling around with each other begin a wild ballet. At first, it looks like a fight, but then I see that it is a full-blown, rough-and-tumbled dance, choreographed intrinsically by play. It is rhythmic, gorgeous, dominated by curvilinear movements and rat-a-tat paw slaps. There are no signals of aggression. The cats make soft eye contact. Their hair is smooth instead of bristling. Their claws are retracted and their fangs are covered. They make sounds, low shrieks of joy, that are particular to this, and only this, behavior. I almost need a slow-mo camera to catch the intricacy of the movement, and I feel something deep inside me. A visceral thrill, something pure and primal. My linear thoughts get overridden by the epiphany of this moment. It seems as if a spirit of divinity has infused these magnificent cats. A spirit of joyousness in physical form. Something more than reflex, something intrinsically creative. I am reminded of Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, when the title character is at the limits of his endurance in his struggle with a giant marlin. All of Santiago's dreams of storms, fish, women, and fights fall away, leaving only a dream of lions playing on the beach, like cats in the dusk. This is the essential nature of play. It remains when the importance of so much else has fallen away. A few miles and a million years from the spot where I watched the lions, I can find the reason. The great plains of Africa are also the birthplace of modern humans. What we know from the fossil record, molecular biology, and animal behavior studies suggests an interesting story.
As the rainforest dried out and became savanna, pre-hominids descended from the trees and began walking upright.
By messing with stones and sticks, and by playing together as juveniles under the protection of adults, the hominids that survived the harsh climate changes on the Serengeti gave rise to animals that were more dexterous with their hands and had better color vision and an upright stance. But it is what was going on inside the brain that was even more important. our primate predecessors began to imagine and to vocalize thoughts, first in playful gestures, then in the hunt for prey and the search for edible carcasses or nourishing vegetation. Over time, as a result of lengthening childhood play period, these primates learned to control their tendencies to dominate and fight, and began to be able to reconcile and care for each other. This is how they gained wisdom and survival skills. Those who missed out on play couldn't tell friend from foe, misread gestures, got rejected by potential mates, and floundered. The non-players didn't survive. Those who played survived, adapted, and developed skills and capabilities that their ancestors could never imagine. Which is why I find hope in a world in which there is warfare, suffering, vengeance, poverty, and cataclysm. Play has always been a key to adaptation and survival, and I believe it will remain so in the future. One network newsman thinks it is likely that through play, we will find a way to change our behavior and better address global warming. In fact, nations may well rise or fall on the basis of their ability to honor our evolutionary prerogative to play. Why do I say this? Three reasons: social, economic, and personal. Play sets the stage for cooperative socialization. It nourishes the roots of trust, empathy, caring, and sharing. When we see another human in distress, that distress becomes ours. Games, sports, and free play between kids set the foundation for our understanding of fairness and justice. Just as my friends and I did in the streets of Chicago, kids argue about the rules of fair play and negotiate about what rules are right for the pickup game at hand. When sports and games are played as they should be played, organized for the fun of it, kids learn that cheating is wrong and that playing the game the best you can is the thing that matters, although many coaches would rather operate under the Vince Lombardi dictum, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." Play lowers the level of violence in a society and increases communication. For example, even when there are big social or economic gaps between people, they can often find common ground talking about the local sports teams. If diverse, clashing ethnic or cultural groups can be coaxed to actually play together, the positive effects can be dramatic. Nate Jones, whom we met earlier in this book, is a Long Beach master mechanic sought out by premier race car drivers worldwide. He has a heart for, and has established a foundation for, marginalized kids, and uses play techniques to get them to open up and cooperate. He was once invited to a Los Angeles reform school for serious juvenile offenders. Lacking any verbal entree to them, he packed in a soapbox derby racer he had designed and began to assemble it in the presence of a pack of kids clustered in separate groups, each of which had their own standoffish, too cool for school attitude. Some of the kids started watching what he was doing. As the sleek contraption emerged before their eyes, they wandered over and asked what he was doing. Pretty soon they were helping. Finally, the car was done. Nate picked the littlest kid, who was Hispanic, to sit in the driver's seat, and a mid-sized but speedy-looking Caucasian kid and an African-American kid as pushers. They had a ball. They really got into jamming the car down the mild grade at breakneck speed. The guards were dumbfounded. Afterward, they told Nate they couldn't believe he had gotten the kids to cooperate. Usually, they said, the different racial groups don't even talk to one another. The only time they interacted was to fight. This experience led Nate to bring other cars for the kids to assemble and race. The essentials of play, as with the polar bear and the husky, overrode more hostile and territorial dimensions and changed a very tense and fragile juvenile prison dynamic. One kid, due to be released, even asked to stay beyond his release date so he could compete in the next car assembly and race. In the adult world, play continues to be woven into the fabric of our culture. In large part, play is our culture, in the form of music, drama, novels, dances, celebrations, and festivals. Play shows us our common humanity. It shows us how we can be free within the societal structures that allow us to live with others. It is the genesis of innovation and allows us to deal with an ever-changing world. Economically, developed nations in which people are not merely surviving will rise or fall depending on how well they understand and institute play. That's because what has been called the knowledge economy is being overtaken by the creative economy. In the early days of the 20th century, industries didn't want workers who could think. They wanted people who could be relied on to repeat the same assembly line motions efficiently. As other nations gained the ability to host those factories, the industrialized countries realized that if they wanted to maintain their standards of living, they would have to work harder or work smarter. Since part of a high standard of living is not working 12-hour days for 6 days a week, most people would like to work smarter. A knowledge economy is based on the advantages of its strong educational system, computing power, and analytical abilities. But guess what?
It turns out that many of the developing countries are generating a flood of pretty smart people, too.
Production design, software coding, computer processor manufacturing, and market analysis can be shipped off to countries overseas. The advantage that countries like the United States, Britain, France, Germany, the Scandinavian nations, and Japan retain is the ability to invent, to dream up solutions to problems that people may not even know they have. Nations that remain economically strong are those that can create intellectual property, and the ability to innovate largely comes out of an ability to play. As part of my play activities, I have been consulting with high-tech companies over the past few years to help them become more innovative through play. One of them has R&D and other creative engineering labs overseas. I recently spoke with the executive of a worldwide engineering company with labs in the United States, the Czech Republic, and China. He was troubled that the highly trained engineering personnel in China were not coming up with many new ideas, techniques, or technology. The U.S. and Czech teams were doing well, with the United States in the lead. As a result of being convinced that play and innovation were inseparable, he established a Play Week on the island off the China coast and a similar camp in the Czech Republic. The Chinese engineers showed a bump in morale and productivity, and thereafter games and free time for imaginative invention were integrated into the work week. The engineers not only worked better together, but also came up with more effective ways to work and more original solutions for design problems. The interesting thing is, the Czech engineers didn't really take to the extracurricular activities. They already had recreational activities that they enjoyed, and any group activities outside work only took away from those. The good life. The world needs play because it enables each person to live a good life. What do I mean by that? What do we need to make life meaningful, fulfilling, and worthwhile? This is a question, perhaps the question, that has dominated the thinking of philosophers, artists, religious leaders, and common folk through the ages. Their advice, rules, prescriptions, and proscriptions provide guidance on what to eat, wear, say, think, and worship, even how to die. Now I will give you my take on it. My advice on how to live a good life is not so specific. I won't tell you exactly what you can or cannot do, think, or feel. For me, a fulfilling life is one in which we live and grow in accord with our true, core selves, in harmony with our world. A successful life is one in which we are able to fulfill our own basic needs and give of ourselves to others. We are happy when we can live an expansive life, one in which we are aware that we are actively participating in something greater than ourselves, a part of a loving couple, a friendship, a family, an intellectual, social, or spiritual community. When I take a long-range view of life through the lens of biology, evolution, psychology, personal experience, and the views expressed by sages through the ages, I see that being playful has an important role in every sphere of our lives. As I've shown in the previous chapters, we are designed by nature to grow and develop in large part through play. Of course, we need food, shelter, sleep, and love. But even if we have taken care of simply surviving and reproducing, play is what allows us to attain a higher level of existence, new levels of mastery, imagination, and culture. When we get play right, all areas of our lives go better. When we ignore play, we start having problems. When someone doesn't keep an element of play in their life, their core being will not be light. Play gives us the irony to deal with paradox, ambiguity, and fatalism. Without that, we are like the Woody Allen character in Annie Hall, who says, "What's the use? The sun's going to blow up in 5 billion years anyway." Living a life of play doesn't mean always choosing the most pleasurable or fun path, however. Joseph Campbell, the brilliant scholar who documented how people across all cultures and all times are essentially living by common mythologies, is probably most famous for his advice to follow your bliss. But he had to add a clarification, because some people took this to mean that they could forego anything that was unpleasurable or distasteful. I worked closely with Campbell for several years, spearheading the effort that led to his many PBS series. What he believed was that people should find the path in life that fuels their spirit, that speaks to them on the deepest level. But Campbell also showed that this path is sometimes hard. If your bliss is just fun and excitement, then you are on the wrong path, he would say. Sometimes pain is bliss. A friend of mine had an experience when this really hit home for him. A guide was taking him scuba diving on a cold morning. The boat ride out was jarring as the boat slammed through a choppy sea, and the sky looked stormy. My friend was griping about all these things, expressing his unhappiness with the cold, bumpy, wet day. Finally, the guide said, "You know, Josh, you are never going to have peak experiences if you don't let yourself go through some discomfort." At that point, he stopped complaining and started seeing things differently. Yes, the sea was choppy, but there was also an awesome quality to the sea, a kind of grand power in the way it tossed the little boat. In the flat overcast, he could see that there was a beautiful chiaroscuro of light and dark where rays of sun broke through the clouds. And they were doing it, the two of them in the midst of nature, about to breathe below 60 feet and 100 tons of water, where no man had a right to be. He had a great dive.
For me, some of my best memories are of duck hunting with my father and uncles on late October pre-dawn mornings in Nebraska along the Platte River.
For a 12-year-old boy given the chore of anchoring duck and goose decoys with bare hands in a river flowing with slush ice, it was excruciating. But the prospect of drinking hot chocolate in the duck blind, listening for the first rustling of wings, and hearing the stories of past hunts and family adventures while waiting for daylight was then, and still is right now, evocative of a grounded sense of happiness. While both my own world and the rest of the world have changed, and I no longer enjoy hunting, the emotional residue gives me joy. Just hearing the honk-honking of Canada geese as they cavort unthreatened year-round along the Carmel River makes me 12 again for as long as the sounds echo from the valley walls. One of my regular playtimes now is to ride my bike along a steep, winding road near my home. Growing up in the urban south side of Chicago, I never imagined that I would, at 76, be pedaling up a mountain road surrounded by redwoods, laurels, live oaks, Monterey pines, and blooming chaparral. So the very setting is novel, and for me, is bliss. But the uphill slog is slow, grinding, physically demanding, as my aching thighs and lungs beg for relief. I am no kid. Yet even the uphill climb, while I am puffing hard and wondering if my brakes are dragging instead of my aging body, is peculiarly emotionally uplifting. As the top beckons, I am suddenly out of the woods. The road opens to a panorama of ocean and woodlands. The light is different on every ride, the push worth it. And on the glide home, my spirit is clear, happy, at one with body, nature, spirit. I have had similar moments emotionally when poking through neuroscience literature and finding an aha, such as the realization that REM sleep and play share similar brainstem evolutionary biological patterns. So the ride up Robinson Canyon, though physical, and the glow while reading, though sedentary, are for me close to identical states of play being. That is play bliss. One of the hardest things to teach kids is how to make it past difficulty or perceived boredom to find the fun. "This hike is boring," says my 9-year-old grandson, who loves his video games. But as we keep at it anyway, he slows down and begins to notice details. A four-leaf clover, a hawk carrying a writhing snake aloft, the sound of a strong breeze in the trees. Nature, with all its novelties and the play emotions stirred by its wonders, gets through to kids if the immersion can be tailored to fit their temperament and natural curiosity. They might be on a bike ride and look at a hill and say, "I don't want to climb that. It looks too hard." What they don't know is that there is a really fast, fun ride down the other side. We've done it before, so we know that the effort uphill is worth the payoff on the other side, but all they know is the difficulty. It's the same way with work. They understand the difficulty, but they don't stick with it long enough to understand how satisfying it is to do something really well. You have to make it through the discomfort to find the fun. True play is even one step beyond this. Making all of life an act of play occurs when we recognize and accept that there may be some discomfort in play, and that every experience has both pleasure and pain. That is not to say that bliss is suffering. My take is that following your bliss may be difficult, demanding, uncomfortable, tedious at times, but not really suffering. In the end, the good feelings we are left with, like my memories of the bike ride or the duck hunt, are far greater than any difficulty we encountered as we played. Advanced play, the black belt of play, comes when we realize this and act on it. As long as we are acting in concordance with our central truth, then the outcome will be positive.
When we fully internalize this ethos, our work is our play, and our play is our work, and, as Michener noted, we have a hard time telling the difference between them.
Play on. At this point, I hope you have become convinced of the importance of play. Now the only task is to bring more play back into your life. I say back into your life because almost all of us were full-on players when we were little. You only need to stoke a fire that has always been in you. How do you do that? That's the question I often get from people, and while I hate to lay out rules for play, I will provide some guidelines. 1. Take your play history. The primary purpose of the play history is to get us back in touch with the joy that we have all experienced at some point in our lives. Find that joy from the past, and you are halfway to learning how to create it again in your present life. It also can be a guide to free-flowing empowerment by identifying natural talents that may be dormant or that may have been bypassed. What we will review here about taking your play history is provided only as a starter for a more complete play history available online. I hope this primer will offer insight and motivation to proceed further. From my experience in interviewing individuals who want more play in their lives, I have discovered that it usually requires at least 90 minutes of concentrated but emotionally open, unhurried time to achieve positive results. This is not a quiz. It is not a test. The play history is a journey through your past and present. It is a time machine, a screen that will show you things you may never have seen clearly, or remind you of things you have long forgotten. Most people find that it brings up more questions than it gives answers. One of its goals is to create a general mental picture of your play attitudes and color them with emotion-laden scenes. Your current feelings about people, things, and activities are rooted in the emotions you previously experienced and forgot in the natural amnesia of early life. Start this exercise by spending some time thinking about what you did as a child that really got you excited, that really gave you joy. Was it reading comic books, building a treehouse, making stuff with mom and dad? Did you like doing this with other people, or in solitary, or both? Were the things that really fueled you more mental or physical? Try to remember the feeling that you had, and recapture it. As part of this remembrance, if visual images spring to your mind's eye, amplify them. Let your associations to them flow. To what or to whom do you attach your unalloyed feelings? Some people have a hard time remembering what they did for play, and even more have difficulty remembering the activity in enough detail that they can really re-experience the feeling it gave them. It's not easy, but it's worth putting in the time to do so. Understand what your unique play temperament is and how it has manifested itself as you have matured. Then start to identify what you could do in your current life that might let you recreate that playful feeling. Identify activities that fit with cultural norms and your play personality. Reject judgmental or skeptical thoughts as this exercise moves along. Inventory the whole of your life with an eye toward play and look for ways that accentuate joy. Here are some initial questions. When have you felt free to do and be what you choose? Is that a part of your life now? If not, why not? What do you feel stands in the way of your achieving some times of personal freedom? Are you now able to feel that what engages you most fully is almost effortless? If not, can you recall when you were able to experience such times? Describe. Imagine settings that allow that sort of engagement. Search your memory for those times in your life when you have been at your very best. These are usually authentic play times and give clues as to where to go for current play experiences. What have been the impediments to play in your life? How and why did some kinds of play disappear from your repertoire? Have you discovered ways of reinitiating lost play that work for you now in your life? Are you able to imagine and feel that the things you most desire and enjoy are really the things that you ought to have? Why so or why not? How free are you now as you play with your spouse or your family? Or do you treat them as an extension of a dutiful responsibility? Look at your job and what parts mesh well with the person you are. If your work is not satisfying or you are contemplating a major change in your job, be honest about whether it is the right one for you. Have you been able to imagine yourself functioning more joyfully in another setting? This exploration doesn't require immediate practicality or reality. After all, as a kid, your fantasies and pretend stream of consciousness is what added richness to your mental repertoire. The same mechanisms still can be activated, and your brain will ultimately help shape these imaginative flights of fancy to fit what is actually possible. But it doesn't happen without the emotions associated with a state of play. Here is an example of the activation of play histories in the lives of two of my friends. Lloyd is a physician I know who realized that some of his happiest memories were working in the kitchen with his mother. Though a busy family physician, he started baking bread on the side, discovered he really liked doing it, and found himself gravitating to more and more intricate bread recipes. He shared his hobby with one of his best friends, Miguel, a local high school teacher who also liked to bake. They set up a more elaborate stove in his basement and began to leave freshly baked loaves at friends' doorsteps. The friends were enchanted. Soon the basement became an enterprise after friends raved to the local coffee shops, then restaurants. These businesses began to clamor for bread. Lloyd and Miguel took leave from their day jobs, bought a truck, and really got into it as a business. Lloyd relates a memorable moment that happened early one morning when he was driving his bread truck to a delivery for the Pebble Beach Lodge, and en route, he pulled up beside an MD colleague on his way to make hospital rounds. The totally astonished look on his friend's face still evokes raucous laughter in the telling. This hobby became a franchise, which the founders sold when their play urges were fulfilled. Lloyd then had the leisure to pursue other play-based dreams. Long a closet genetics scholar, he became a university-based, self-taught research scientist who could choose his own agenda. Miguel has pursued his love of bicycle racing and now mentors a stable of young racing hopefuls. Each has gone on to be empowered emotionally, financially, and physically. 2. Expose yourself to play. Every day, everywhere, there are opportunities to find play. Throw a tennis ball for a dog, pull string in front of a kitten, browse in a bookstore. Here's an old piece of advice that is trite but true. Stop and smell the flowers. The world is full of humor, irony, joy, and objects available for aesthetic appreciation. The trick is allowing yourself to open up to those influences, to see humor in virtually all situations. People begin to close themselves off to play when they start to feel that they should always be serious, always be productive. After all, we are adults. Soon, they don't even notice the opportunities for levity or simple aesthetic appreciation. Activities that, by all rights, should be play, like a game of golf, can be treated like a self-improvement program or a chance to get ahead in some way. Simply taking a moment to deeply inhale the air after a rainstorm or kick a pile of leaves can be a private little moment of play. More powerful yet are activities that really pull us into play, like getting down on the floor to play blocks with a child. One PhD I know, Fred Donaldson, did this because as a professor, he wanted to understand at what point in their lives his students seemed to have lost their desire for learning. He ultimately found that this zeal for learning still existed in preschool nurseries and open kindergarten settings, but was squelched soon after. This discovery changed his life. He resigned his professorship and focused his life on understanding play and learning. This led to his many contributions through his original play workshops. His play shops vary with the audiences. Before the end of apartheid in South Africa, he got white police officers to engage in play with black kids from Soweto, with the result that mixed-race teams engaged in sports and games together. A radical departure at that time, fueled by play. For more conventional groups, he has devised techniques that slowly bring play signals into focus, allowing a group of strangers to become play partners. Usually, soft eye contact initiates the exercise, with dance movements, curved hand-arm gestures, and a cascade of playful romping, with the sounds of much laughter the outcome. Remember our descriptions of curvilinear movements in the polar bear sled dog play, or other depictions of rough-and-tumble play? Donaldson is a real original talent in bringing states of play to nursing homes, schools, and settings where the atmosphere is dismal or cooperation has been lacking. His mentoring of others in original play has changed many lives. 3. Give yourself permission to be playful, to be a beginner. Probably the biggest roadblock to play for adults is the worry that they will look silly, undignified, or dumb if they allow themselves to truly play, or they think that it is irresponsible, immature, and childish to give themselves regularly over to play.
Nonsense and silliness come naturally to kids, but they get pounded out by norms that demean frivolity.
This is particularly true for people who have been valued for performance standards set by parents or the educational system, or measured by other cultural norms that are internalized and no longer questioned. If someone has spent his adult life worried about always appearing respectable, competent, and knowledgeable, it can be hard to let go sometimes and become physically and emotionally free. The thing is this. You have to give yourself permission to improvise, to mimic, to take on a long-hidden identity. Let your body respond to lessons learned from nature, but long suppressed. You can't be truly open to spontaneity if you don't feel comfortable testing novel ways of expressing yourself, pushed along by the pleasure of the action. Play is exploration, which means that you will be going places where you haven't been before. A friend of mine, Daniel, has been skiing for 30 years and was pretty good at it. But it had gotten a little stale and predictable, and he didn't get the thrill out of it that he used to. Like a lot of people, he decided to give snowboarding a try. Also, like a lot of people, the first day out, he couldn't go 10 yards without catching an edge and slamming down hard on the groomed snow. He remembers being amazed at how much abuse the human spine could take and still keep functioning. Little kids blew past him on their boards. At this point, many others in this situation would give up and go back to skis, but Daniel kept at it.
He kept falling, but also kept laughing at how ridiculous he looked, even laughing when he got a beaut of a bruise.
By the end of the first day, he was getting the hang of it, and by the third day, he was pretty good. The thrill and challenge of the slopes was back, too. "It sucks being a beginner again," he told me. "But unless you are willing to do that, unless you can let yourself feel okay about going through the awkward stage, you can't grow. You'll always be stuck in the past. Fun is your North Star. But you don't always have to head north." As I've pointed out, looks can be deceiving. People may be playing tennis, but they live or die with each point and ruminate over bad shots or strategy. They are preoccupied with winning and, if they don't win, will see themselves as losers. This is a tennis game that is clearly not play. Another person might be sweating and grunting as he digs the foundations for a deck, but the truth is that this sort of home improvement is what he loves doing best. When looking for play that really works for you, the easiest way to find what works is to experience what's fun. The trick is, of course, that some of the really transforming acts of play aren't purely fun. Camping requires packing for the trip and unpacking afterward. Sailing requires boat maintenance and sometimes delivers wet and cold episodes on the water. Producing any artistic creation includes moments of frustration. As I've noted, Joseph Campbell expounded on the importance of following your bliss, but that doesn't mean that you should do only things that produce easy fun. If you do, you will be shortchanging yourself. Be active. One of the quickest ways to jumpstart play is to do something physical. Just move. Take a walk. Do jumping jacks. Throw a ball for the dog. A double play boost. Motion is perhaps the most basic form of play. We are designed to start moving when we are in the womb. When a grinning and gleeful infant pulls himself up on his feet, you can see in his face the pure pleasure of this little triumph. Remember the sea squirt? It has a brain only when it is moving through time and space, and for us, such movement is fundamentally pleasurable. We are alive when we are physically moving. Neuroscience research is showing that the fundamentals of perception, cognition, and movement are very closely connected, and that the circuits for higher functions, such as planning and recognizing the consequences of future actions, require movement. My study of depressed women who were successfully treated through endurance running demonstrated that for me. This research preceded my focus on play, but in retrospect, it upholds the power of movement and play to fill an aching heart. Through running, these women discovered a source of vitality and emotional confidence without a lot of intellectual investigation. The physical play bypassed the cognitive roadblocks and built new neural pathways to happiness. 6. Free yourself of fear. Fear and play cannot go together. Take a look at your environment and look at where you are unsafe. Is your job in constant jeopardy? Recognize if your body is tight or tense in certain situations. Does your spouse or partner have a critical attitude so that you are always half expecting to be run down for simply existing? If you fear the boss's retaliation or are a naturally anxious person, discover ways to find safe havens. Liz Goodenough, a National Institute for Play advisor and a professor and expert in children's play, says that developmentally, we all need secret spaces in which we can be safely alone and give ourselves over to needed fantasies if we are to adapt to a challenging world. Find your own secret space. Find out what it is in your surroundings that prevents a sense of trust and well-being that would allow play to emerge. This is not always a simple or easy task, but unless you examine and change these influences, your life force will be trapped. Finding your play is worth it. The ability to play is there in all of us, and is transformative when it is rediscovered. 7. Nourish your mode of play, and be with people who nourish it too. Practice play. Understand what type of player you are and find ways to engage in your play. It won't happen automatically. In fact, if you have been out of the habit of playing, there will be all sorts of habitual resistances and barriers to keep you from playing. Play is nourishing, but you have to take time out for play, just as you would take time out for a meal. And that doesn't mean doing the play equivalent of fast food. Television sitcoms don't usually count unless you haven't laughed for a while. A lack of play should be treated like malnutrition. It's a health risk to your body and mind. Be aware of play killers. Part of nourishing your play is putting yourself in an environment that supports and promotes that play. As I've just noted, this is most obvious if you are in an abusive or fearful situation, either in a relationship or at work. If you find yourself often talking about or taking on someone's troubles, or find yourself in a supportive role in which you listen but cannot actually do much to change the situation, that too is a play killer. If you are in a relationship in which your interests and ideas are not taken seriously or appreciated, that too is a play killer. If people around you cannot learn to understand your need for play, find people who do. Find the play that feeds your soul, builds an environment where people understand your need, and get out there and make it a priority to stay play nourished. At play in the world. Bowen White is a medical doctor, a distinguished pioneer in stress medicine, who, through a serendipitous suggestion by his physician friend Patch Adams, was transformed.
While White was on a mercy mission to Sarajevo after hostilities had ended, Patch had him wear a clown costume when he ministered to wounded and orphaned children.
To White's surprise, he found a natural outlet for saying and presenting his medically based humanitarian truths to not only kids in need, but also to other professional audiences. He discovered a play personality within himself that had lain dormant since his acting days in college. In addition to his humanitarian pursuits, White began to gain a wider professional audience by setting up a staged program for medical audiences. He would start a formal presentation on the physiological effects of stress, and then be called away for an emergency, staged by the organizer of the conference. Soon, dressed in an outlandish clown costume, he would unexpectedly burst in on the staid conference as Dr. Yurko. "That's Yurko, you dolts!" Now totally unrecognizable as the professional physician who had spoken earlier. White has a gift for speaking the truth of the human condition most powerfully when in this guise, and in the process, he creates wildly unexpected play scenes that fix the truth of his message in the minds of audience members. White charges thousands of dollars for this sort of routine at business conferences, but he also continues to perform charity work regularly for disadvantaged kids around the world. Recently, White visited an orphanage and affiliated children's hospital in El Salvador with Patch. This was in many ways a sad place, an underfunded and neglected repository for sick and abandoned kids. White and Patch first did their doctoring, and then they worked their magic, making the children laugh and clap for the two American doctors and a party of clowning nurses with big red noses and wild costumes. The kids didn't speak English, but the clowns didn't need to speak any Spanish. They found that comedy and play are a universal language, accessible to all ages in all cultures. It was clear by the end of the day that all had touched one another's hearts. At one point in the day's events at the hospital orphanage, White was cradling and kissing an infant.
After being asked what motivated him to be there, he looked at me and said something that has always stuck with me.
"I really do this for selfish reasons," he said. "I need this kind of connection, and you don't have to come to San Salvador to experience it. There are play and love, and they connect people at the deepest level. Play allows me to enter this situation. Play doesn't solve all the serious suffering, unfairness, or the problems we see in the world. But when you experience it, particularly with a child, it opens your heart, and then you see what's inside. Play helps you regain the mind of the child and better deal with the major problems and challenges we all face. For me, this gets to the heart of the matter. Play is how we are made, how we develop and adjust to change. It can foster innovation and lead to multi-billion dollar fortunes. But in the end, the most significant aspect of play is that it allows us to express our joy and connect most deeply with the best in ourselves and in others. If your life has become barren, play brings it to life again. Yes, as Freud said, life is about love and work. Yet play transcends these, infuses them with liveliness, and stills time's arrow. Play is the purest expression of love. When enough people raise play to the status it deserves in our lives, we will find the world a better place. This concludes Play by Stuart Brown, M.D., with Christopher Vaughn.
Narrated by Michael Hinton. Copyright 2009 by Stuart Brown. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with Avery, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.